Hello, and welcome to Building Sustainability Podcast. I'm your host, Geoffrey Hart, aka Geoffrey the Natural Builder. Building Sustainability consists of conversations with designers, builders, makers, dreamers, and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. Well, hello, and welcome to episode 47. This week, we're with Bill Browning and Katie Ryan to discuss biophilic design. If this is your first episode, then welcome. Enjoy yourself, and be sure to check out some of the other episodes. If you're a regular here, then welcome back. It's great to have you. So, first up, a little bit of podcast news. This is the first episode from my new home in Exmoor. I am coming to you from the little caravan on site. It's a bit damp and musty, but that's all the more incentive to build myself a little house quickly. The place is full of birdsong, which you might be able to hear in the background. It's honestly pretty perfect, and the sun has been shining for the last week. I feel incredibly lucky. So what else? Yes, I want to tell you about Triodos Bank. You might have seen a lot in the news recently about how the big banks are still investing billions of pounds of your money in the fossil fuel industry. Triodos Bank are one of the good ones, and they actively invest in green energy and community projects. So there is a code in the show notes which will get you £60 when you open an account with Triodos, and I get some money to donate to charity when you join. So everyone wins. And just to be clear, I'm not in any way being financially rewarded for this. I am purely recommending this because I think it's the right thing to do. What else? Oh, yeah, Patreon. If you find this podcast informative and you want to help support the show, then head to patreon.com/buildingsustainability. There is bonus audio from many of the guests. There's a couple of exclusive episodes up there. I'm going to be putting another exclusive episode up shortly within the next couple of weeks. So some people who have done just that since the last episode are Jules Baker, Joanna Ensom, and Karen Ridgewell. Two of those went for the carved wooden spoon option, and I have been sat out in my garden carving away some beautiful birch wood. So I look forward to getting those sent out to you. So yes, thank you so much to those new subscribers. You absolutely rock, as do all the existing subscribers. Genuinely, it helps me so much. So thank you. There's a link for that in the show notes if you're interested. And then finally, before the episode, I also wanted to say a huge thanks to Karen Ridgewell. Again, not only a Patreon supporter, but she also contributed our latest bite-size episode all about the fellowship she's found in the sustainability sector. It's a truly excellent listen, and make sure you check out. And her partner even recorded a nice little intro music for it. Yeah, very nice indeed. Okay, on to this episode. Bill and Katie are from Terrapin Bright Green. The blurb from their website says, "We believe that connecting people with the environment will lead to a healthy, prosperous, regenerative future for all. We leverage high-performance design, whole systems thinking, and research in biophilic design, bio-inspired innovation, and ecological design to make this a reality." So I've been so excited to bring this this episode to you. As for me, biophilic design is the bringing together and scientific explanation of a huge part of what I do. And it's the thread that ties almost all of these podcast episodes together. It explains why building with natural materials or dyeing fabric with plants, carving a spoon from some wood or being in nature, why that all makes us feel so good. So yeah, I'm really excited for you to get into this and understand what it's all about. I'll be back at the end. I should say there is a whole load of links in the show notes to all the things that get talked about. And I should mention that there's a little bit of background noise, some sirens and some Tweety birds. But I think everyone is kind of used to the home recording quirks by now. I'm back at the end. Enjoy the episode.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I worked at a NGO called Rocky Mountain Institute for 17 years and started a group there doing green building research and consulting. And we were looking at aspects of productivity in green buildings. We were seeing these really surprising numbers on increases in productivity in green buildings, and we couldn't find anything in the literature about that. So we decided to write about it, and along the way, after publishing, we met an environmental psychologist named Judy Heerwagen, and we were kind of noodling around what would be the why were we seeing these jumps in productivity? I mean, we're saying, well, it's better daylighting, it's better visual acuity, it's better thermal performance. And Judy said, well, there's kind of a larger context, and that's this conditions that are better habitat for us and our connection to nature, and introduced us to the term biophilia. And that was 1995, I think. And so we just started collecting everything we could on the topic. And then in 2004, working with Stephen Keller, helped put together a conference to bring together designers and researchers to have this conversation about connection to nature in buildings and in the built environment. In 2006, I had left Rocky Mountain Institute to work on a real estate development that unfortunately didn't get finished, didn't get built, but went back into consulting, and with friends in New York City started Terrapin in 2006. And biophilia was one of the things, you know, we were all sort of passionate about right from the beginning.
And then, so when you've said there that you were doing green building, what? There are many different kind of interpretations of that term. What was sort of your focus there?
So a lot of our initial focus was on energy efficiency, because that's what Rocky Mountain Institute is best known for, but indoor air quality and materials choices and all of that. We helped launch the U.S. Green Building Council in 1993, and were involved in creating the LEED rating system as well. So, and we still, as Terrapin as a company, still do a lot of green building work, usually on sort of weird, complex buildings, the challenging ones. And we get into net zero energy. We also do work in biomimicry, innovation inspired by nature, asking literally, how does nature do that? But this experiential design component is really one of the things we're best known for.
Okay. And how do you come into this, Katie?
Well, my background is in design as well, but more on the communication side. But that's how I started off. And then I ended up being in the Peace Corps in Thailand, the U.S. Peace Corps, and where I was working a lot with teachers and local scientists, largely on environmental issues that also related to public health and economics with indigenous communities and displaced people. And so that's where I started to put all the pieces together for myself, figuring, and I wanted to work in the built environment more than just in the, what's on paper. So I went back to school and got my master's in international development, but I focused on green building and more green infrastructure issues. And that's how I came across Terrapin. And one of my early projects there working with Bill was on biophilic design. I'd say our first real inquiry, active inquiry, was in 2010. We were working with Delos. It was always a conversation in the workplace, but a first concerted effort at Terrapin, I think, was 2010. And we're looking at how we might consider communities, community development and the experience of the community, and what kind of research there was existing already that supported healthy experience of neighborhood development. And ever since then, we've just, it's kind of taken off with the publications and a lot of workplace design, but also master planning and other project types.
The book, Nature Inside, always forgot what it was called, is fantastic, by the way.
Oh, I'm glad you got your copy?
Yes.
Already?
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah, it's got the sort of perfect amount of, really beautiful photos that are really sort of inspiring, but then good text, which is full of information.
Yeah, we were fortunate to be able to include so many color photos. It was a great way to complement the storytelling.
Yes, and it works as well. It's it's quite a soothing thing, which is the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what is biophilia then?
The word itself comes from Eric Fromm, the social psychologist.
From the 1960s,
yeah. And literally word bios, right? Nature, love. So philia, love. So love and nature. It doesn't really though get it's in an essay that it does, but it doesn't really get a lot of traction until Harvard biologist Ed Wilson writes a book in 1994. Called biophilia, and his experiences in love of nature, and so you see the inherent connection to nature is his definition, or innate connection to nature, and then he and Stephen Keller at Yale and some other folks pulled together a bunch of folks to have a conversation about, is this real? Is there science here? And they collected a bunch of papers together and published that as a book called The Biophilia Hypothesis. And in 1994, was that?
Yeah, I think actually biophilia was 1983.
Could have been. Yeah.
And then Biophilia Hypothesis was 1994, or 93, 94, that in general time frame. I think the most popular cited, or most frequently cited paper that kind of sets the tone for the science behind biophilia is the 1984 study by Ulrich that looks at gallbladder patients in recovery rooms in a hospital. And he's really looking at, you know, how all things equal, aside from their view, you know, how they respond to treatment and how quickly they recover, and how much medication they need, and what kind of complaints they get from, or comments they get from their nurses, and ultimately the patients with the view to nature versus a view to a brick wall. The patients with a view to nature recover faster, take fewer medications, have fewer negative comments. And so it kind of set the tone for how we think about the value of a view to nature. And a lot of the research that's come after that has tried to either replicate it or, you know, use the same same general intent to show where this, you know, how the experience of nature can have such a profound effect on our psychological and physiological well-being. So there are dozens upon dozens, hundreds upon hundreds of studies that we can identify certain experiences within nature that translate to health and well-being. And so, you know, looking at how those characteristics or patterns in nature can be reflected in the built environment based on the science, mostly in neuroscience, environmental psychology, and a few other fields of science. There's a lot there to support those patterns and help us rethink, you know, how we're building, how we're designing spaces.
And the responses tend to fall into several broad categories. A lot of evidence on stress reduction, both psychological stress, but also stress measured through galvanic skin testing, heart rate, blood pressure, heart rate variability, even using cortisol, the stress hormone, testing for that. So there's a lot of studies around that. There's a lot of work around sort of the cognitive impact, how the brain's functioning and what parts of the brain are responding or not responding, and how we're processing the environment when we're experiencing nature, which is different than how we process things typically when we are reading a book or trying to do a task or other stuff like that. Then also work on just how does it impact our emotional state, our mood, and our preferences for places. So we find that these different experiences may support one of those outcomes or may support all three of those outcomes. It sort of varies depending on the experience.
Yeah, and also who's experiencing it, because you know, some of the solutions might be universally applicable and other ones not so much or not appropriate. So understanding who you're designing for is often a key component to recognizing which elements of nature are most appropriate.
Lovely. So, I mean, that makes it sound like we are at our best as humans when we're in nature. Is that the sort of what we're getting at?
To a certain extent, yeah. I mean, you know, when you think about it, we've only had buildings for about 5,000 years or so, right? And, you know, and certainly communities have not been around that long. And so we lived in nature. And so that's the... Yeah, that's the conditions that the human body and mind are set up for. And so when we, you know, and today, most of us spend 90% of our time indoors, and probably over the last year, more, unfortunately. And so it would make sense that, you know, if we wanted the indoor environment to support us as best as possible, that we think about bringing in elements of nature into that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to say
just well, how exciting it is for me, because I've come to this from building with natural materials and using sort of very raw local materials, sort of wood in its unprocessed state wherever possible. And in all that time, there's been this sort of talk of like, oh, you know, they just feel better. My mental health is better. But there never seemed to be any, you know, science backing that up. And then it was only probably 6 months ago that I first sort of clocked the term biophilia. And now suddenly it's one of those ones where it's everywhere, and it's, yeah, I keep seeing it. And the more I research it, the more it just seems to sort of, really, it's sort of my whole ideology. And so it's sort of fantastic to know that there are all these other people doing, you know, researching it in ways that I couldn't as a builder.
Well, it's definitely gained traction since the pandemic. I mean, it had, I think since 2012, it had really started to surge. But the pandemic definitely made the conversations, whether the term biophilia was in the conversation or not, the talk about, you know, connecting with nature, definitely. You see it in the news, you see it in Instagram, you see it everywhere. But how did you come across the term?
So I was talking to a couple who, they grow trees into chairs.
Yes, I've seen those. Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if I've seen his or theirs, but I've seen that done before.
Yes. So what's interesting about them is that the guy, Gavin, he started off with I think he had a twisted spine, and he spent a lot of time as a kid in hospitals looking out the window at the view, and then mm-hmm. has sort of then gone on to be, you know, now he's shaping trees. He shaped his spine already, and now he's shaping the trees to sort of, you know, so he's sort of come all the way around on that. And talking to them, and they said, oh, yes, biophilia. And I went, What was this? Yeah, and that's led me down this rabbit hole.
That's a great story.
It's a great story. We joke that what we're just trying to do is find the science behind what we intuitively already know. I mean, we get it, right? You know, on an intuitive level. In fact, we actually have a proposed project right now. Which, crazy as it seems, there's all this evidence on that we really love wood, right? And there's lots of, so there's a whole field called visual preference. You know, what are the things that people like to look at, and what do they really like in spaces and materials and that? And wood is one of the ones that elicits some of the highest responses. But we don't know why.
That's interesting. I always find it interesting that we appreciate wood, you know, to see the grain in it and things like that. But that's not how we see trees. You know, trees, right. The grain is all, right. You know, inside the bark.
One of the neuroscientists we work with says, yeah, it could be what's called semantic processing. So we see a piece of wood and the brain goes, oh, wood, tree, alive. It might be that. It could also be we have a really strong response to collinear patterns. When we see them, or radial patterns, or nested patterns, it's easier for the brain to process it. It takes, you know, a set of lines moving roughly in the same direction, even if they're curving, is one set of neurons that's firing, and as opposed to when you've got a really complex scatter of lines, then it takes more effort for the brain to process that. And we like it better when it's easier to process. And wood grain definitely has that collinear nature to it. So it may be part of that as well. Wood might also be a fractal pattern, so where you have repeating layers. And we know that we have a really strong response to fractals as well. So it could be any of those, but it's something we want to, we've got a proposal in right now to potentially dive in and talk to some of the neuroscientists and some of the folks doing this work and say, what's going on? You know, why do we see this response with wood?
And not with other materials, man-made in particular. Yeah. Why doesn't plastic elicit the same response?
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. We've sort of talked about the mental benefits to you know, being in nature and having that maybe that inside as well. Well, you make a pretty strong economic case in your book.
I'm glad to hear that you think it's strong in the book. Like, I haven't gone back to read it myself since publishing it, so I kind of forget like what we covered. The part of the reason we get into economics in the first place was that, like Bill was saying, early on, getting buy-in was a little difficult. People like the idea of it. That's really cool, but who's going to pay for it? So that's what instigated us, the publication, Economics of Biophilia, which was published in 2012. And it really was, I mean, in my opinion, that's kind of, that was the catalyst. That's what got people really interested in application. And it's also when we started working with Google and on some of their projects, or trying to understand what some of the science was behind it, like do a little more digging. And I think one of the strongest arguments that we could make back then was for the workplace.
So we started seeing things like increased sales per square meter, and we were seeing obviously the work in hospitals, because so much of the early studies were in hospital. And you know, if someone takes less painkillers and get out of the hospital a day earlier, that's an enormous cost savings
to the hospital and the families. Yeah,
definitely.
And students performing better in classrooms, and less absenteeism in workplaces, and just people changing their attitude. So one of our favorite really early case studies was a bank headquarters in the Netherlands, what's now called ING Bank. And Dutch architect Ton Albers designed a headquarters for them based on Rudolf Steiner's anthroposophical design. And so it's these 10 small towers with atriums coming down through each of the towers, and these light sculptures that bounce colored light around inside the towers, and handrails with these cast bronze sculptures called flow forms, where water splashes down the handrails, right? And you see bankers in suits playing in the handrails, and gardens, and just this, right, extraordinary. It totally changed the bank's self-image. It totally changed the public's image of the bank. And it's really funny, because at one point, I wrote about it in the early 90s, but later on we got pulled into this question about a potential lawsuit on the bank wasn't part of, they'd gotten these tax incentives for energy savings, and the bank wasn't producing those energy savings anymore. And, you know, this was really a problem. And it's like we sort of stepped back and said, well, of course it's not producing the energy savings. The bank's gotten so popular, you have half again more people in the building than it was designed for. And the building's so popular that they have weddings there and bar mitzvahs, and they have birthday parties and the community events, and the thing's rented out. And so, you know, a bank is open, right, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. No, this thing's open 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., right? Because everyone wants to be in this building, right? So you add all that up, of course the energy use is going to be a lot higher. We should be happy for that a building is that loved, that, you know, a bank, that people want to be in this building. It was just extraordinary.
That's fantastic.
So the economics of biophilia, like, it looks at all those angles that Bill's mentioned, you know, different sectors of society and or building types. And then we did an exercise where we extrapolated, you know, from a few studies or examples, like, what would that mean at a larger scale, at, you know, say, for the community or for the state or the nation, you know, what does that look like in financial terms, just to give people a better picture of, like, what the potential is. And, you know, the calculations are done using US dollars and labor statistics and things like that. So the numbers don't necessarily apply, say, in Britain, but the same thinking still transfers over. It's, you know, it's going to be the same. So it's really, really kind of eye opener to see, like, what kind of impact you could have. And that document is actually, it was written for people to understand context and maybe take it to the policy level or take it to their community or their, you know, their, whoever's leading their initiative and say, like, look, well, this is, we can do this. This is possible. So it's a very different context than, say, like, the 14 patterns of biophilic design, which is much more design specific, design oriented. So we're trying to, you know, reach a broad audience, and, you know, translate the science, in a way that people can really, get excited about it and want to learn more.
Yeah. It's kind of a shame, isn't it, that just saying, it's going to make people healthier and happier and better isn't enough. Then you have to sort of say, and it's going to make you richer.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things we've, you know, forget, you know, particularly coming from the green building world, where we're all focused on energy and carbon, which are really, really important. But what we forget when we look at the cost of a building per unit area, the cost of people's salaries and benefits and all that is more than 90%. Of the cost of a building on an annual basis.
For a workplace.
For a workplace,
For a hospital, I think it's like 55% or something.
Yeah, in an office building, it's over 90%. So the energy use is like 1% of the total cost. It's still really important, and we really need to pay attention to that. But let's also remember that let's keep the people healthy and happy and boost their experience. You know, a way to sort of flip that around is, in an office building, 1% gain in productivity is typically equivalent to the entire energy bill.
Wow. Yeah. That's a strong case.
Yeah. And then any other boost to productivity after that is going to be, you know, profit and a happier employee base. So that's, there's nothing bad about that.
Solid common sense. Okay, so how is it that we do this? You mentioned patterns. Well, I noticed you seem to have gained a pattern.
Yes.
Now 15 patterns. But let's start with, just for the sort of uninitiated, what is a pattern? What does that mean?
Well, for a little background on pattern, there's so many different words that people use to describe an instance, or, like, you know, attributes, characteristics, elements. We wanted to streamline the language, at least that we use, so that we're not confusing each other. And we chose pattern largely because pattern language is already a phrase or term that's used in the architecture world. And Christopher Alexander's work is quite well known. And so it just, it fit really well with the way we wanted to tell our stories. So we chose the term pattern, but largely because that's how we experience these. We don't necessarily talk about them outside the world of architecture and design. We don't necessarily talk about them as patterns. They're experiences in nature, but we've actually started to come to talk about them as these patterns are experiences in nature. And I think it becomes more of a narrative when we start using the word experience. But the 14 patterns that we started off with were strictly based on the amount of research, like whether there was just enough research out there to legitimize this thing as one of the patterns, this experience as a pattern. So there are other lists out there that are longer, but these 14 initially were the ones that we found to have enough research to support them in our science-based approach to biophilic design. And the 15th came along later because the research basis for it over the years has built up to the point where we begin to understand it better and realize that there really is something here to share and talk about. So that's the background of the patterns.
And they fall into three broad categories. The first we call nature in the space, which are sort of direct experiences of nature in space. So being able to view nature or experience nature through sound or taste or touch, having water, having variable light, breezes and temperatures, seeing the changes in seasons and the natural processes. Those are all direct experiences of nature. The next category are what we call natural analogs, which are representations of nature. So using natural materials, wood, stone, having fractals in the space, having biomorphic forms, either in the materials formed into biomorphic forms or even just as patterns.
Or the architecture itself, yeah.
And then the third category are three-dimensional experiences of space itself. And so probably the most famous of those patterns are prospect and refuge, which comes from work by an English landscape geographer, Jay Appleton, in the 1970s, wrote a book on the experience of landscape. And he kind of asks this sort of basic question of, why do I look in one direction and really say, wow, that's a beautiful view, and then turn my head 90 degrees and go, maybe not so much. What makes up the difference of that experience? And two strong things that came through again and again were, first, this idea of prospect, which is an unimpeded view through space. And it turns out that prospect's really good for lowering our stress level and our perception of safety in a place, but also this idea of opportunity. Oh, maybe that's a good place to go over there.
Decision making.
Yeah. Then refuge is where my back is protected and I may have some canopy overhead. Yeah. So think about if you come into a classic pub, you have round tables in the center and around the perimeter, you've got high back booths. Where does everyone want to go to first?
Straight to the booths, yeah.
There's a reason for that.
There's a reason for that. Suddenly you have refuge. But you also now you have a good view across the whole rest of the restaurant. So now you have prospect and refuge together, right? So if I can create those two together, you know, or another classic old form building would be the ingle nook next to the fireplace, right? So prospect and refuge. In those patterns, we've also identified mystery, which is where there's partially revealed information that you feel compelled to go explore to learn more. So it can be the curving path, right? Or the curving, on a classic high street where you've got the road curves, you want to go see what's around that corner, right? But it could also be sound, right? Or the smell from the bakery, right? And you get pulled down the street to go see what's in that window, what that smell is. Risk peril is another pattern. Standing, looking over the railing in a tall building is, you're not going to fall, but it's a little exhilarating, right? Unless it's a dopamine response in the brain. It's a little, don't want to use too much of it, but it makes for places much more interesting. And then the newest pattern is one that we suspected and knew about, but we couldn't, until recently, had enough science for it. And I'll let Katie describe that one.
Oh. So awe or something being awe-inspiring. Initially we thought of it as more of potentially a combination of the patterns that Bill just described, like prospect and risk and any number of, maybe there's a smell. There could have been multiple patterns involved, but we couldn't really put a finger on it. So this idea that you could walk into at the edge of a canyon or into a cathedral and you stop, like you're almost, your body is just compelled to stop and look up or look out, your eyes open up, your jaw drops. And there's this moment. That actually there's research behind it that shows that that is a specific experience. And that it also elicits very specific response, like health response, particularly pro-social behavior, where your humility and Bill, am I missing some?
More charitable, yeah.
More charitable, yeah.
Heart rate changes, blood pressure changes. I mean, it's this whole cascade of things happens all over.
But it's very distinct from the other patterns. And it is one that I think is captured really well in certain types of architecture, but isn't necessarily easy to obtain or to create, to recreate that experience. So it's a really special, special thing to be able to add to our list, but it's still known as the 14 patterns. So we're trying to socialize this 15th pattern. So it's a fun one to talk about. Especially in these times, like when there's just that need to open up and feel connected to people, but you can't always actually physically be connected. There's a way to indirectly connect. Yeah. So
we'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Wonderful. If we could, I'd love to go through those patterns and just talk about how, like maybe a couple of quick examples of how they might be implemented.
So one would be complexity and order.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Biomorphic forms. I'm going to pick two together because the two we're finding frequently get interacted. So fractals are a great example of complexity and order. They're mathematically repeating patterns. And we typically, when you talk about fractals, people think about exactly repeating things at scale, things like the patterns called Mandelbrot sets. And those are regular fractals. And they occur, but more frequently in nature, you have fractals that are still mathematical patterns, but they're not exact. Right, so think like a snowflake or a fern leaf or the dappled light under a forest, right? Those are all what are called statistical fractals. And they have a mathematical density to them. And when they're in the mid-range, which is where they most typically occur within nature, when we see those in human-designed objects, It's much easier for the brain to process, and so it lowers our stress. So the neuroscientists call that fractal fluency. The brain is fluent with fractals. Now, what implication does that have? We had ran a year-long experiment that was put together by an architect in Baltimore, Maryland, Jim Detterman, in partnership with Morgan State University and the neuroscience team at the Salk Institute in California. And it was in a sixth grade mathematics classroom in an inner city school in Baltimore. And the experiment was literally minimal changes in the classroom. So putting down carpet tiles by a company called Interface that had a pattern that's like waving prairie graphs, adding a wallpaper frieze around the top of the classroom that was an abstraction of palm leaves. And then on the window where there were Venetian blinds on the windows, replacing those with a fabric blind called a Mecco shade that had the patterns of tree branch shadows silk screened onto the shade. And so creating a statistical fractal there as well. And then watching what happened with those children over the course of the school year. And what we found was their test scores were significantly better than students using that same classroom with the same teacher teaching the same curriculum in the prior year. And we also did 4 months of biometric testing where we did heart rate variability, and we compared one class with a control class held at the same time. Seventh grade and sixth grade math class, for both running at 90 minutes in the afternoon, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday measurements. And what we saw was that the stress level of the students in the seventh grade in the control classroom was pretty much the same, unchanged when they got into the classroom and when they left the classroom. Whereas in the biophilic classroom, the stress recovery characteristics improved dramatically by the end of class. And so, you know, that's an experiment and a minimal intervention, right? Carpet, wallpaper, window blinds.
Yeah. I've particularly enjoyed in that case study, I was going to bring it up later, actually. One of the difficulties that they said they faced was actually stopping the teachers covering the walls with their, the things which you normally stick up in a classroom.
Yeah, the neuroscientists say that is overstimulating. It's actually counterproductive, particularly for younger children.
Yeah.
But the hardest part of that was getting, because that's such been habit for so long, that the teacher's annual evaluation is partially based on how much they put up on the walls. And so we had to get a special dispensation that the teacher would not be downgraded for only having three on the walls at any given time.
That does bring the question, like, if that's part of the system, the education system, like public schools in the U.S., I don't know how common it is across the U.S., but if that's a common practice, we're doing our children a disservice and essentially knowing that we're doing it. Like, that's a lot harder to undo. I would think that convincing school boards across the country to change that might be a little more difficult than it sounds.
I'd say so.
And one of the pieces we don't talk about a lot was there was a garden outside the window, and the garden was enhanced. A landscaping company added to the garden, and kind of thought the garden would be the focus, right? That would be the driver of everything. And it did have an impact, but when it had an impact was in the month of April, when the trees bloomed outside. because most of the school year they didn't have leaves. And so you had these trees that are up on the second floor. And but when they bloom in April, you see a spike in the data. And then by May, it drops off again back to the earlier data trend. And so the view outside did have an was important, but it was basically important for that period in which the...
So that was the only differing factor in April, was like everything else was the same except that the plants, the flowers were blooming.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Wow.
Well, I was thinking while Bill was talking, I was trying to think of like what other patterns should we highlight today. And one thought is that visual connection with nature and this idea of like bringing plants inside or just having access to plants is usually a default for most people. It's like it's something very easy to incorporate. But so my instinct would normally be to not include that one because it's so easy. But I think it's actually worth talking about because it's, I think, not necessarily misunderstood, but the opportunity isn't optimized or realized because the science that we've been able to put together highlights very specific experiences of nature that are even more beneficial. So it's not just that there are plants. It's that when you incorporate plants, that there's some biodiversity there. And it's not necessarily a more is better. It's the quality of the incorporation of plants, the quality of you know, say the biodiversity, maybe the amount of interaction or like a proximity. And if it's not in your personal home, maybe it's like in a workplace, that it's accessible to everybody. So it's not just about putting plants everywhere. You know, having one place that has good quality seating, comfortable seating next to a biodiverse habitat-like seating area could be more effective than just having plants, you know, a monoculture distributed throughout the, or actually, I mean, the research shows that it is more effective than having a, you know, just the same kind of plant distributed throughout the facility. So, yeah, there's that, some thoughtful attention to incorporating plants. But I think another easy, with that in mind, also considering like the depth of view, which is something I think with this whole work from home, I have a feeling that a lot of people are sitting at their desk in front of a wall, often. And so you don't have that depth of view. You might have plants in your house, but if you can't see beyond a couple feet, then you're not giving your eyes the chance to relax. And I actually was speaking with somebody just this weekend. She stepped outside after working in front of the computer all day and she got dizzy. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry. I've been sitting in front of my computer all day. It's like, you don't have a view. You don't have a distant view or a view to nature or something beyond your little bubble. And so again, it's more like thoughtful application. You know, what are you actually trying to accomplish here?
And there's some of that's just a physical effect, right? If I'm staring at something that's less than a meter away all day long, to see that near view, the muscles in the eye contract around the lens. And they're, you know, contracting and eventually they're going to get fatigued and then the lens mm-hmm. starts to harden in that form. So if I can get you to look up and look away at something more than 30 meters away, more than 100 feet away, then now I'm in what's called the infinite visual focus. It's one of the different focal ones. And to get to that state, all the muscles in the eye relax and the lens flattens. So if I can get you to look up and look away every 20 minutes or so, or even more frequently, I can get that physical relaxation. Now, sometimes the headache that people are getting is just because it's
muscle fatigue,
right? You know, and then you get the you know, and as your muscles get fatigued, you start, you know, getting in weird positions trying to change and you get away from it or change. When just being able to look up and look away at a distant view, that in itself can help.
It only takes about 20 seconds for your eyes to relax. I mean, if you're doing it regularly, every 20 minutes or so, it takes about 20 seconds for the muscles to relax, and then you can get back. So it's not enough time that you get distracted from whatever you're doing. It's just giving your eyes a break. And then to the science that Bill was referring to earlier, it only takes about 40 seconds. So 20 seconds for your eyes to relax, but 40 seconds before your stress levels can go down.
Right.
So it doesn't take a long time. I mean, obviously, if you can be physically in nature for a little bit longer, it's going to be more beneficial. But when you are committed to sitting at a desk, like, there are small interventions that can, like looking up and away and out to nature, that can have a profound impact on you, your physiological well-being over the course of the day.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, it seems like this is sort of the golden time to really be talking about this. It's so fitting for this sort of weird moment.
For people who are going to be more permanently, this seems temporary, and it will be temporary for some people, but other people may continue the work at home more permanently. And so I think more care in what their permanent workplace situation is going to be is really going to be critical.
And even just having a picture of nature, right? If I don't have a good view to the outside, even just having a picture of nature to look at will lower blood pressure and heart rate.
Wow. So even a digital representation of nature.
Yeah, it's not as effective as the real, but it does help. There is good evidence that, particularly if it's a landscape, a really beautiful landscape will elicit that response. And if I look at it for just 40 seconds, the prefrontal cortex quiets down. And so the brain's processing in much less energy intensive state. So after looking at it for just 40 seconds, I come back and now I've got better cognitive capacity. I'm recharged and ready to go.
That leads me on to something I wanted to say, that because of the way I've approached it, you know, natural materials, creating natural forms, you know, it sort of runs in that very obvious sort of plane. But I was surprised to see that, you know, pretty much the very first picture in the book is of this gorgeous form that's come out. Is it of a cooling tower, or it's the Museum of African Art?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Very industrial.
Yes. But you found like a section's been cut away and it's created this sort of beautiful, nature-esque environment.
Well, biomorphic, yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And it was somewhat unexpected. They were just kind of like, okay, what can we do with this? And I think they were pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. And so you know, that's a big thing made out of concrete that's not a natural material as such, but can achieve that same effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, partly that they were trying to stay true to the history of the agricultural connection. And so it makes sense to utilize it in the way that they did. Yeah. So I suppose whenever, it just depends on what your goals are for a given project and whether you are using what you have versus bringing in new materials. And, you know, not every place is going to have a lot of wood or the kind of soil that you might build with. So you have to think more creatively about how to connect to the ecology of the place.
So I think context is what we're talking about there. And you talk about that a lot in the book. Why is that so important, and sort of how does a building have context for its environment?
Partially it's a response to the climatic conditions of the place. And also just the sun angle, and how does the sun move around and through an animated space. There's the cultural context, but there's also the ecological context as well. Let's do architecture that refers to where we are and makes a tie to where we are. There's too many buildings and things that are placeless. And we hope that through these experiences of nature in the built environment, that gives you better appreciation for the natural environment, and hopefully that you'll want to be inspired to help preserve the natural environment and restore it. And so that tie to place is really, really important.
I don't know if it's a sort of international term, but we would call that vernacular architecture. Mm-hmm. And certainly our older buildings are all of their place because in the past it would have been hard to ship materials around here. You'd have to be very wealthy. And so the regular people all built homes from what was there. And that, mm-hmm. And it's very much of the place, just sort of the place reconfigured. Really nice that's being talked about so much, and the actual benefits of that being understood.
Right. I think about the extraordinary golden stone in the Cotswolds, right, that makes those beautiful cottages and buildings there, and the blue green stone you see up in Inverness and Western Scotland, and right, the just even how the color of brick changes in different places based on the clays and the places. So just having that is really helps define place, but also can create really incredible architecture.
Yeah, definitely. Great. Well, I mean, I feel like we could talk about this for hours, but I think we should probably wrap it up. Is there anything that you wanted to sort of close and sort of say?
Enjoy our book.
Yeah. So would encourage people for sure to get a copy of Nature Inside, a Bioflick design guide published by the Royal Institute of British Architects.
Just went into its second printing.
Also, there are lots of publications on the Terrapin Bright Green website that people can download for free. Mm-hmm. A whole bunch of them on biophilia, but also on biomimicry and other topics as well.
Yeah, and there's quite a few people in Great Britain who are active in this world. So there's a lot of resources out there, and BRE Group is also interested in this topic. So I think that the resources are there to continue the conversation locally as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our talk. Well,
thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It was enjoyable. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Well, wow. Thank you so much to Bill and Katie for taking the time to discuss the world of biophilic design with us. If you are interested to find out more, follow the link in the show notes to their article, 14 Patterns of Biophilic Design. I'd say that's your top further reading link. Also, check out their resources pages on their website, terrapinbrightgreen.com. They have a new report on working with fractals, which Bill mentioned a few times. And so that's my next good read this evening. Looking forward to getting into that. We ran out of time in our conversation, but I really wanted to know their thoughts on designing with the golden ratio, which, for anyone that doesn't know, is the ratio that's repeatedly found throughout nature. I suspect that it's part of the complexity and order pattern. But maybe I will ask Bill and Katie for some thoughts on that and try and get back to you for the next episode. With this conversation and reading their book, I have really been shaping up the design of my tiny house. I've been making conscious decisions to bring in visual connection with nature. That is through choice of materials and thinking about the views and how I can reduce that sort of putting yourself inside a box feeling. So today, after listening to this episode again, I realised that my desk is pointing in entirely the wrong direction, and that it doesn't have any kind of view beyond where my laptop will sit. So it is back to the drawing boards and having a little reshuffle there, see if I can come up with a slightly better design. I think it's it's a tough thing. The tiny house is a really compact sort of Tetris of all the things I want in my space, with not really any room for excess space to move into. So we'll see if I manage that. All being well, I should be starting the build in a few weeks. So look out for updates on that on my social media. You can follow me at Jeffrey, the Natural Builder, or you can follow Building Sustainability Podcast, which is on Instagram. Okay, well, that's it. Enjoy your week. Enjoy rearranging your room so that you get a better view from beyond your working from home laptop. And of course, if you've enjoyed this episode, please do share, tag me in it. It makes a great difference to getting new listeners involved. So yeah, big love. Bye-bye.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.